It's 94 degrees.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Swire's Land and Management Company, Danville; EAGCO Incorporated, Fairmount; Springfield Electric, Springfield; and Cannon Farms, Camargo. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. There are an estimated 20,000 community gardens across the country. One of them, the Randolph Street Community Garden, sits in Champaign's oldest residential neighborhood. Over the past decade, this garden has grown from 8 beds to more than 30. Supporters say community gardens offer more than low-cost fresh food. As part of our series on health and wellness, CU Citizen Access reporter Pam Dempsey has this report.
Champaign's oldest residential neighborhood sits inside Church Neal and Lynn Streets. Known as a sesquicentennial neighborhood, it's also home to the Randolph Street Community Garden, one of 20,000 community gardens nationwide. Community gardens are shared spaces where residents can grow and harvest their own food. The garden is overseen by volunteer Don Blackman, who also runs Culture Club, a youth program at a nearby church.
The biggest benefit is building community. I mean, we have people who come to garden here who might not meet one another otherwise, and who establish relationships and learn about one another because they are part of the garden. It also helps because so many people I'm a renter. I don't have a backyard. This is my backyard.
Blackman became the garden steward in 2006 as a way to continue the club's garden bed when the garden faced closure for lack of staff. Today, she manages the garden beds, maintains equipment, organizes events, and keeps up with the garden's website. The garden grew from 8 beds in 2006 to 32 beds today. Neighbors near and far have staked claims on the beds. Don's youth group grows produce for the Eastern Illinois Food Bank and other social service agencies. Children from the Culture Club meet once a week to get a lesson in cooking and sharing. Earlier this spring, children piled into the Church of the Brethren building on nearby Neal Street for their weekly cooking session. They put on paper hats and aprons and got busy chopping and dicing the produce that Don Blackman had ready for them. It was soup day.
Well, today is Thursday, and on Thursday, any of the children who drop into the Culture Club make soup for the Time Center. We do it as our regular Thursday activity. In the summertime, we use vegetables from our garden. In the wintertime, we have to go with canned and things, produce that we get from Eastern Illinois Food Bank.
The kids move around the kitchen with ease and seem reluctant to move out. The weekly cooking sessions, too, have more than one lesson.
They're learning things that they can do at home. They can make, once by the end of the season, they've made almost every kind of soup imaginable, and they can make them home.
Between growing produce and cooking it, the kids are adding something else to the list, selling it. Last year, they sold their first cash crop in front of a fish market down the street. The children who helped sell produce were allowed to keep 20% of their sales.
My goal is to have a cash crop for the garden, that the money goes to build new beds when we need new beds, replace tools when we need tools, get new hoses.
At the Randolph Street Garden, 5-year-old Cody Sweet is learning to plant sunflowers. His mother, Clara, says that the garden grows more than food.
And it's just really helped develop lots of friendships, just with the people you grow with and harvest with, and then you just have that, those family members.
For Illinois Public Media, I'm Pam Dempsey of CU Citizen Access.
The growing movement to produce food in East and Central Illinois and make it available to all is the focus of a day of programming on WILL AM 580 and WILL TV this coming Thursday. To learn more, visit our website, will.illinois.edu. Our media engagement initiative on health and wellness is funded in part by a grant from the Lumpkin Family Foundation. Midwest corn crops have seen better days. This time of year, corn is usually dense, green, and lush. But in much of Illinois, miles of fields resemble thinning heads of hair. All of this is from the severe drought that's gripped the region, and it's raising corn prices. The dry conditions have Illinois Governor Pat Quinn worried about farmers and food prices. So far, 33 Illinois counties, including Champaign, have received disaster designations because of the ongoing drought. Governor Quinn toured the southern part of the state Monday, and he spoke to Illinois Public Radio's Michael Puente about what he saw during his visit.
Well, I was just with Donnie Laird, who's a farmer here, generations of his family have been farming, and they've never seen anything like this. We went through this cornfield. We were trying to find an ear of corn. We finally found one. It was about 4 inches long, and, you know, it looked like something you put in a salad. And Illinois is a mighty corn-growing state, same way with soybeans, and it relies on water. And hadn't rained here since June 11th, 0.6 inches. You know, more than a month has passed, and, you know, we cannot grow our crops without a decent amount of rainfall. So,
well, you have mentioned a little bit of what the state is doing. Can you be more specific on what can the state really do? Is it through government grants or is it like loan modification program?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of loan modification for crop production and also for just rescuing farmers who planted their fields. They had great optimism at the beginning of this growing season, but you know, with the drought, we're going to lose a large part of our corn crop. Both the federal programs and the state programs are in that direction. There's one that deals with some of the fields that are called CRP, Conservation Reserve Program. They can be used to feed the livestock. Very, very important, our livestock in Illinois, that we export quite a bit. They'll not have anything to eat, and they're hurt by the water shortage as well. So this is really a crisis.
Now, obviously, some of the corn crop down south is already lost. Could there have been anything the state could have done or you have done earlier to prevent any of this from happening?
Well, you got to pray for rain. I think anybody who's concerned about our agriculture in Illinois understands that without water, you can't grow things that count, like corn and soybeans and other crops. So, you know, this is a situation, a natural disaster. We got to pray to God that it starts to rain across our state of Illinois. One thing that could be done right now in Washington is passing the Farm Bill. You know, they're kind of in the House of Representatives still debating that, and that one of the best ways to help our farmers in crisis is to pass the federal Farm Bill. And I talked to the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture today, Tom Vilsack, and he asked me to plead with our members of Congress from Illinois and the House of Representatives to get the job done and get that bill passed, because that'll help our farmers now, and they need it.
Well, what do you say to farmers, though? Some of them in Illinois have said you kind of reacted a little slow on this. They didn't see where you were at until recently. Do you feel like maybe you could have declared some of these counties a disaster area a little bit earlier?
Not really. Last week, we declared 26 counties disaster areas. We now today have another 7 that qualify. You got to meet the federal rules for disaster assistance. That means 8 weeks of severe drought, and it also means that at least 30% of the corn crop or whatever crop is affected. So those requirements are necessary before you can declare anything a disaster area.
That was Illinois Governor Pat Quinn. He spoke with Illinois Public Radio's Michael Puente.
Come along on our custom-designed trip to England and Wales this September. Experience the real Downton Abbey in a private tour just for friends of WILL. See lovely Cotswold villages, the Yorkshire countryside, and meet Alan J. W. Bell, producer of Last of the Summer Wine. Tour Greenway, Agatha Christie's home, the English spa town of Bath, and visit the Jane Austen Center before wrapping up the trip in London. Our tour is almost full, so call 217-333-7300 for more information.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of advertising items, name badges, plaques, and trophies. They can also design and create unique awards for any occasion. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. More information is available at 351-7958.
And here is the writer's almanac for Tuesday. It's the 17th of July, 2012. It's the anniversary of the founding of Harvard Dental School, 1867. It was the first university-based dental school in the United States. Before it came along, if you wanted to be a dentist, you went to a trade school or you learned by apprenticing yourself to another dentist. Dentistry was not yet considered a branch of medicine. And before the 19th century, your options for treatment were very limited. If you had a toothache, you went to the barber surgeon or even a blacksmith to have the tooth pulled. No anesthesia. If you had the money, you could have the gap filled with a replacement tooth, which you could buy from somebody who was willing to sell a tooth, or if you didn't want to pay that price, you could buy teeth from a cadaver. Sometimes teeth were collected from battlefields. They were referred to as Waterloo teeth. Some people had dentures made from ivory or porcelain or even gold. After Charles Goodyear invented the vulcanization of rubber, you could buy hard rubber teeth, which were known as vulcanite. But around the time Harvard Dental School was founded, 1867, dentists were starting to use chloroform or nitrous oxide to dull the pain. It was on this date in 1917 the name of the royal family of Great Britain was changed to Windsor by King George V. Queen Victoria had been of the House of Hanover, and she had married Prince Albert of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha. But the royal family's close ties with Germany became a sore point during World War I. And when German heavy aircraft started dropping bombs on London, aircraft called the Gotha, George V, who was a grandson of Victoria, changed the family name to Windsor after Windsor Castle. The German emperor, Kaiser Wilhelm II, was also Queen Victoria's grandson, and he joked that he was looking forward to seeing Shakespeare's play The Merry Wives of Saxe-Coburg, Gotha. It's the birthday of one of the best-selling authors of the 20th century, Earl Stanley Gardner, born Malden, Massachusetts, 1889, who gave us the trial lawyer Perry Mason, who was so brilliant he not only got his client off the hook, he also tracked down the real guilty party. And it's the birthday of the comedian who said housework can't kill you, but why take a chance? Phyllis Diller, born in Lima, Ohio, 1917. 9 years ago, Phyllis Diller donated her jokes to the Smithsonian, a filing cabinet, 48 drawers, more than 50,000 jokes on index cards. Here's a poem for today by Roy Sheeley, Woman Feeding Chickens. Her hand is at the feed bag at her waist, sunk to the wrist in the rustling grain that nuzzles her fingertips when laced around a sifting handful. It's like rain, like cupping water in your hand, she thinks, the cracks between the fingers like a sieve, except that less escapes you through the chinks when handling grain. She likes to feel it give